Yeah, turn it out for a moment. Can you turn the other one off as well, maybe? And Rose, you can, when I ask, you can turn the light on again for us there, okay? Okay. I'm going to make a... Hang on, let me put this on. No, no, it's fine.
Michael, I've still got my original one. Falling to pieces.
Falling to pieces. Angus and Robertson, yep. Good.
They need rubber bands.
They do. They do. Look, I'm going to make an executive decision, and although there's a lot in on First Hearing a Cuckoo that we haven't unpacked, I could spend another hour or 2 hours unpacking it, and you might feel at the end of it that you've really grasped the content of that poem. I'd like that poem to settle with you, and next week we might come back, and if people have particular questions, I'd like you to read that poem again over the week, make some notes, have some thoughts and questions about it. But I'd like to move on, and we've got 40 minutes left. I'd like to look perhaps at a couple of the early poems, Cap and Bells first, and which was probably produced in about 1943 when Red was 18, crossing the Harbour Bridge one evening on a train, and another one produced a year later, Poem for Easter, 1946. And I'll also say a little bit about an old record before we finish. So that's the four early poems that you have in your little anthology. Cap and Bells was actually, it's an early poem, and it was the title that we gave, when I say we, myself and Brother Athanasius McGlade, who was at the Australian Catholic University where I teach. He died, I think, 2 years ago now at the grand age of 99, and he taught until he was 98. But he and I were responsible for some of the early seminars on Francis Webb back in the 1990s. And it was when I published God's Fool that Angus and Robertson asked us to put together a collection of Webb's poems, and that was this one called Cap and Bells. Why did we call it Cap and Bells? Well, it also raises the question, why did I call my book God's Fool? And, you know, there's an interesting aspect to Webb's lifelong ailment, as far as I see it. And that is that there's almost a sense in which he was not happy to be lionized as a famous poet. It's almost as if somehow he wanted to step aside from the grandiosity of what a normal life might bring him. There's this amazing line on page 5 in your book from one of the poems in his sequence, A Drum for Ben Boyd. What fascinated Frank Webb about Ben Boyd was that Ben Boyd was a kind of a Donald Trump, in a way, of the early 19th century, immensely successful businessman, opened banks up, whaling stations, had incredible kind of success, sheep stations across the Monero. Boyd Town down in Eden is kind of a remnant of his empire. You can go there and you can see the old Boyd Lighthouse, the pub that was built at the time. There was a bank there. But for some reason, Ben Boyd, at one point in his career, turned his back on everything, as some people I know are hoping Donald Trump will. And he scuttled ship. And this is how Frank Webb describes it. in the second stanza of this poem on page 5. Success was the terror that might have tensed his back to an unnatural arc, turned him away, outpatient, healed, and thoroughly dead to his right mind and fate. Outpatient, thoroughly dead to his right mind and fate. You know, I share this with you, but I remember when I was 21 going to a psychiatrist and feeling that the psychiatrist was straitjacketing me more and more and more. So, you know, what was going through Webb's mind? And when we come back to page 3, Cap and Bells, you can turn the lights off again, please, Mari. You know, Cap and Bells, of course, I'm sure you all know, are the insignia of the fool. And in King Lear, of course, the fool is the agent that subverts the hierarchy. And in fact, perhaps brings Lear back to some form of sanity. Now let's listen to this poem, written when Webb was about 18. Tonight the stars are yellow sparks dashed out from the moon's hot steel. And for me now, no menace lurks in this darkness, crannied by lights. Nor do I feel a trace of the old loneliness here in this crowded train. While far below me, each naked light trails a saber of blue steel over the grave, great peace of the harbour. Webb used to travel across that bridge to where his grandparents lived in North Sydney or Chatswood often. To know this peace is to have outgrown thoughts of despair, of some driving crank of fate, of corroded tissues in the bleak shell of a town. Darkness, lights, happiness, all are right. All bear messages of the hidden heart. And for me always, the grave, great peace is stronger in flaring colours and a laugh and a careless singer. Die in the blood and salt of your thoughts, and die when the columns of your sun are thrust aside and broken. But I have chosen the little obscure way in the dim shouting vortex. I have taken a fool's power in his cap and bells, and know that in my time the haggard prince will discover a blunt shell of Yorick that laughs forever and ever. And these are the lines, of course, from Hamlet, when Hamlet finds the skull of Yorick, who was also a jester. Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. He hath borne me on his back 1,000 times, and now how abhorred in my imagination it is. My gorge rims at it. Here hung those lips that I have kissed, I know not how oft. Where be your gibes now, your gambols, your songs, your flashes of merriment that were wont to set the table on a roar? Not one now to mock your own grinning, quite chapfallen. Now get you to my lady's chamber and tell her, let her paint an inch thick to this favour she must come, make her laugh at that. A blunt shell of Yorick. I've chosen the little obscure way. So, I don't know if you have any thoughts or comments on that poem. I just bring this poem in a way to your attention to give some perspective on what was driving Frank Webb's poetic direction, maybe even his life. I was interested in Michael's earlier comment about on first hearing a cuckoo, that while there was this darkness, there was also this sense of humour. There was this sense of volatility and detachment. For me, always, the great grave piece is stronger in flaring colours and a laugh and a careless singer. Remember, this was written when he was only a teenager. What was driving this observation about his own situation? Does anybody have a thought or a reaction to this? Yes, Michael.
I'm trying to think of the name of the Scottish psychiatrist who wrote, basically saying that, you know, the world is mad, we don't realise it. And normalcy is a mode of madness.
Well, I think of Dürrenmatt, the German. Ardy Lang.
That's coming to mind here. And there's something about, I've met hundreds of people, I'm terribly sorry for them, they wouldn't have it any other way.
That's right. That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. In fact, you know, I teach David Maloof. And in David Maloof, in, for instance, Remembering Babylon, David Maloof often sees the outcast as the source of some real metanoia, sanctification. So there's that whole tradition. And also, I work with Mission Australia, and I know there is one man, young man, mid-40s, a lawyer, never practiced law, but he loves work, being on the street with those people and having some connection with them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there is, in the Russian tradition, the holy fool, that's a very recognized part of their tradition. They're the bearers of wisdom.
That's it. Mari.
B. Miles.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That portrayal of her in
Kate Grenville's book.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it
No. I wonder what dates was she around with B. Miles?
Mid-1940s.
Oh, I knew her as a kid.
You knew her as a kid.
She died about 1971.
Right,
72.
Right. Yeah. It's quite possible that Webb would have known of her too.
Yeah. Died in the Little Sisters of the Poor at Randwick.
Yeah.
Tear away menace for the nuns.
Well, Frank Webb, he was... I talk about this in the book. Norman Lindsay had done illustrations for his book Leichhardt in Theatre, that he famously tore up the illustrations and threw them overboard on his way back to Australia. He didn't want anything to do with that particular format, that aggrandizement that he was getting from Lindsay. To begin with, he enjoyed something of it, but, you know, Lindsay was not a kindred spirit, and he didn't want that kind of acknowledgement or fame. So,
back to the poem, I'm thinking that the word that comes to mind is aberrance.
Which, sorry?
Aberrance.
Aberrance.
Yeah.
Aberrance.
Being aberrant.
Aberrance.
And I think the poet, and particularly someone like Frank Webb, saw himself as being an aberrant citizen.
Yes.
Being a poet and thinking about things that were of no interest.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, you've actually triggered something else for me that's really important here, and it was in our conversation earlier also, and that is that Frank Webb's deep interest in St. Francis of Assisi was in fact his interest in someone who'd thrown off all the garments of financial, material success, and embraced the other. And the other was, for St. Francis, the leper. The leper was the catalyst for St. Francis's breaking down of his own ego. And the first poem in Francis Webb's sequence on St. Francis, which is called The Canticle, and we'll be looking at that next week. You might like to have a look at those poems for next week. The first poem is Frank Webb really dramatizing himself as a leper. So there you have it. In a sense, Cap and Bells is a real prefiguring for that moment. And for Frank Webb, I think St. Francis of Assisi and every part of that story is something that was deep in Frank Webb's own spirituality.
I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, the theme...
Microphone.
I'll speak loud. The theme of the power of the fool.
The power of the fool.
To upset the government ideology.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just to be a fool, but to literally turn the tables on worldly power.
That's right. And in fact, now you've picked up something else that's really important here. In the last seminar in this series, we're going to look at his Ward 2 poems. And his Ward 2 poems, from within the walls of a mental hospital, he endows the characters within that hospital with a normalcy that frees them from some of the restrictiveness of those outside the walls. And you know, one of the poems, we're not looking at it in here, one of the poems is about the homosexual. And Frank Webb embraces that homosexual and gives him real dignity against the opposition of the world. You know, that's where Frank Webb's Catholicism was kind of breaking right out of the conventional mold. And, you know, that connects up in my thinking with a play by Friedrich Dürrenmatt, the German author, called The Physicists, which is set within a mental hospital, and within the walls of the mental hospital there's more sanity than the world dominated by Donald Trump outside. Let's turn to poem for Easter, the first poem in this little collection. Okay, I think you've all seen that illustration there. You can turn the lights on. I just wanted to, just before we lose this thought, Peter over here, just before we had our cup of tea, pointed out that on First Hearing a Cuckoo, on page 6, this relates back to what Ambrose was saying about the question of the power of poetic language as opposed to the power of thinking language and thought that kind of reconstitutes the world through some kind of rational mode. Peter was pointing out the music of the words in the opening stanza. It was never more than the two unchanging words heard first in the coming green of daybreak, the sleepier green than sleep with a sheer white between this yawning advancing green, etc. And Peter had a memory suddenly of actually talking to Francis Webb about why he chose a certain phrase. Would you like to pick up the microphone, Peter, and tell us that story? Because I think that was really interesting.
On?
Yep.
I just asked him about a line in the Ward 2 sequence, the last line, Hitler stanza, he's almost genuflected. And I wasn't sure.
He's almost genuflected.
Genuflected.
Yeah.
And Frank, he said, I thought it sounded wonderfully musical. So I think he's composing. It's the musical sense of the words playing together. If you look at that first stanza, there's double E's. Give a sort of music to the whole thing.
Yeah.
So a big part of his artistry, he was composing
music
like doing a
symphony. Yeah, yeah. Beautiful, thank you. So back to poem for Easter. and we're approaching Easter. So it's appropriate to tune into Frank Webb's own understanding of this event. And there is a quote in the second last stanza, "Be still," which is on the screen, but you can't read it, but I'm sure you know the lines in Mark 4. "And he arose and rebuked the wind and said unto the sea, Peace, be still. And the wind ceased." So here's the poem. In our times... Oh, now the other thing, sorry. Remember, this is written in 1946. This is the year after the ending of World War II. So, and Frank himself, you know, had been caught up in that in a number of different ways. "In our time's passion, the world rattled with stress. Wind-staggered planks pronging the buckled hide, like a spent craft whose sweep hangs listless and empty, twitching in each aimless current without a guide." The sweep, the long oar used in an open boat. "And it was easy enough then to drift about like the sweep under a bare pole for totem and a languid star sagging with its own battles. Our kind of peace dozed over time and death and eternal war. This was the season of death, his ultimate lantern splitting our cone of darkness, his gaping colour marking our path beneath rising weather and water. Well, we would drown quietly, no hand clutched the tiller. The blaze lit death, death only. We can swear this. That racked figure above us," and I've got Grunewald's image up there, "that racked figure above us, like a transfixed gull, hung dead with a slack, dead mouth. Yet whence he came, the voice downwind, a lonely thunderclap crying, Be still! Whose hand pinched out the lightning, crushed the storm. We wandered, drifting on in our dull fashion, soon forgetting the question. But a few hours later, dawn came to some of us in the manner of a vision." I'd like you to reread the poem, and then I'd like you to come to some sense of what you think is meant by dawn came to some of us in the manner of a vision. And I'd like you to speak with your neighbour about this once you've reread the poem. So you two are neighbours, 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 and you two are neighbours. Okay? You're neighbours. In fact, your partners. So reread the poem and then see what you make of that question. What is meant by dawn came to some of us in the manner of a vision? So when you feel ready, please engage with that question. Let's interrupt the flow of questions. See if we can come to some beginnings of a closure on this poem. Anyone like to offer some response to the question, what is meant by dawn came to some of us in the manner of a vision? What did you come up with in your groups? Anyone like to offer something? Yes, please, Gavin.
Yep. For me it was just...
A bit louder, closer to the microphone.
Yeah, afterwards it was more just a brainstorm. So it was obviously, it could just be a literal dawn. But I think for me, I read it against the imagery in the previous stanzas of death and darkness. And the sudden, the dawn of the last time, it's kind of almost like an ecstatic vision in sight.
Okay.
It's almost like, yeah, some sort of ecstatic vision. The image is very powerful.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And obviously connected to resurrection.
Powerful because of what? What makes the image powerful for you, Gavin?
Because of the images of death.
Beforehand.
The
contrast.
Kind of like, you stop reading the poem at the fourth stanza, it's pretty grim.
Yeah.
By then I'm getting a bit depressed, and then suddenly there's an amazing image at the last line of the dawn as a
metaphor.
It's pure feeling, really, pure ecstasy.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thanks, Gavin. Yes, anyone else like to add something? Yes, Michael?
It seems to me the subject of the first three stanzas is the world. It's gone through the war, it's been hell. And then in the fourth stanza, the figure. It is redemptive, but they've forgotten the question that the figure had asked them implicitly in the be still. Do you have the trust? Do you have the faith? Be still. So, in the second last stanza, soon forgetting the question. Now, but a few hours later, they remembered the question and the figure and the redemption.
Yep. Beautiful. Peter?
Yep. Bit of an interesting question.
A bit of a what, sorry?
Bit of an interesting question in the last line, last stanza.
Yep.
In reference to some of us, that why only some people see the light? And a lot of people probably go through their life and that sense of a resurrection or a divine epiphany doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, some people get lucky. But the question.
Yes, Andrew.
The poem is about hypocrisy.
Show us what, how.
And hypocrisy is the fact that there's a Second World War.
Yep.
There's a lot of suffering and death. He also makes a very sort of, I think a very subtle reference to the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Where?
With the seagull.
Yep.
Which is, if you know the poem, the seagull is a symbol of hope and goodwill,
yep,
really, and it gets killed. So, and of course, Christ hanging on the cross is a similar thing in a way. And dawn comes to some of us in the manner of a vision, I think, is more about understanding how hypocritical it is.
How hypocritical it is.
Yeah.
Hypocritical what is?
The nature of Christ suffering and dying for us and then saving us, where in fact death and destruction is not a saving metaphor, really, in that sense. Yeah, that's basically how
I
would see it. Yeah.
Okay. I wonder about the syntax at the end of that second last stanza. Some of you, I'm wrestling with that also. The racked figure above us, like a transfixed gull, hung dead with a slack, dead mouth. Yet whence he came, the voice downwind, a lonely thunderclap, clap, crying, be still. How do we unpack grammatically the question that is being enunciated there through this image of the crucified Christ? Whence he came, the voice downwind, a lonely thunderclap crying, be still.
It's a question.
Not a command.
Wait a minute. What does the word D say?
What does the word be still?
Whence he came. Isn't it saying whence came the voice?
It doesn't say that.
Whence he.
Doesn't say
that. Whence he mean from him?
From where he came.
I think it picks up the image from the Old Testament. Be still.
Oh, whence he came.
That I am God.
God,
if they're quoting from the Bible, or if he's referencing God, a Catholic God, he's an authority figure, basically, and he's pitting himself up against that. And I think this is again cracks in the armour as far as his Catholicism is concerned, and his general sort of religious beliefs. So, yeah.
Yeah, go, Rose.
It's possible that it's referring to the Old Testament. Can you hear me?
Yep.
It's referring to the Old Testament where God is in the stillness. So God is not in the storms and all the horror. God is in the stillness. And it refers to that in that from out of that stillness comes the dawn. But what intrigues me is a bare pole for totem. The fact that it's a beautiful idea that this culture's had these incredibly rich emblems of their identity fixed on a carved piece of wood, and yet for us after the war there was no carvings on the wood, it was just bare and useless really.
I think he's expressing quite a profound faith, which is also profoundly Catholic, namely that in the dying is the living, and Jesus is right at the heart of the horror we've just gone through. Jesus waits for humanity in the brokenness and the dying. And that's the only way to life, is through the dying. But entering the dying without him may just be death. And that's what I think the first three stanzas are saying.
Well, the third stanza, you know, picking up on what you've said there about the significance of death. I mean, the most powerful image for me comes right in the middle of the poem. His ultimate lantern splitting our cone of darkness, his gaping colour marking our path beneath rising weather and water, as if the crucifixion and all the elements of the horror of that embody the path, the direction that we have to go. But then the response to that, well, we would drown quietly, no hand clutched the tiller. So is it dramatizing our failure to recognize and respond at that point? No hand clutched the tiller, we would drown quietly. The blaze lit death, death only, we can swear this. Yet whence he came, the voice downwind, whose hand pinched out the lightning, crushed the storm, we wondered, drifting on in our dull fashion, soon forgetting the question. Sort of dramatizing our incapacity to see and to know and to respond and know what is being indicated in some way.
The context in the gospel is, wake up, we're drowning.
Yes.
And that fits nicely.
Yes. Drowning.
Drowning. You know, there's nobody's got their hand on the tiller, we don't know where we're going.
Yeah.
We've just lived through the most horrific 5 years.
Yes.
You could imagine. And he goes back to the words of Jesus, be still.
Be still.
You can find meaning and hope in this. It's not a blessing of the death and destruction. Death and destruction might just be that, death and destruction. However, it is capable of being redemptive also.
Yeah.
In him.
Yeah. David, did you want to add something?
Oh,
get the...
Yeah.
Please.
what do I want to add? I'll be brief. I first came across Francis Webb at the same time the person that read some of Francis Webb to me put me on to The Hound of Heaven.
Yep, Francis
Thompson. And it was the third publication, I cannot remember it.
Yeah.
But it was a particular time. And today I walked out without my goggles, my glasses. Right. So, you know, the words were a bit blurry.
Yes.
Other than that, I'm very much taking it in.
Good. Did you want to add something, Jared? Can you pass the mic along, please? Thanks.
I thought of Easter morning.
Yes.
When the dawn came.
Yeah, Easter morning. And the dawn, and with that, the vision that comes with the recognition. Yeah. Beautiful. Anne?
Oh, no.
Can I just add something?
Please,
that
yes.
Compliments what Jared is.
Yeah, go, yes.
I think a useful exercise sometimes is to imagine how the disciples of Jesus felt in those hours we call Good Friday and Holy Saturday. They would not have thought of Holy Saturday as holy. That was devastation. That was a black hole. That was a place of horror. It was Easter morning that enabled them to look back through the lens of the empty tomb to see even the cross, the beauty of the cross, the redemption of the death of Jesus.
Good. Anne.
And I mean, I can't really add to my book, but also the confusion on Easter morning. They didn't recognise what they saw. And I always think that's very powerful. And of course, it says it was to some of us in the manner of a vision. They would take a long time to process what it was they saw.
Yeah, beautiful. And did you want to add a final word, Mari?
No, I think
that's it. Okay, well, the bell has gone for dinner. So, for next week, please look over on First Hearing a Cuckoo, and any other questions that you come up against, make a note of them and bring them to the beginning of our session. But next week, we're moving on to A Leper on page 8 and 9, The Jongleur on page 10, and we'll see how far we get with 11, 12, and 13. These are the poems from his book, Birthday. If you want to find some easier poems by him, on page 11 you've got these wonderful poems that he wrote in Galston when he was staying with his sister up near Hornsby in 1952. So look forward to continuing this journey with you next week. Thank you. And incidentally,